All right, I want to start in Mark chapter 12 because it's a passage that has been or will be connected to our Bible reading over this next week, and it is an appropriate place, I think, to start in considering the matter of resurrection as it relates to us. It is one thing to read of the empty tomb in the New Testament, and then the appearances of the Lord afterward, and to try to grapple with how come some of the people who saw him didn't recognize him, and how could it be his body and yet him appear in rooms where the door was shut, and then not be there, and how could this happen in different places at different times, and then to think of the Bible's teaching that we will see him as he is and be like him, which is what we read in 1 John 3 and verses 2 and 3. How do we conceive of something which is inconceivable to us? What are we to make of the New Testament hope of the resurrection? And I chose this passage to begin with because it illustrates, I think, very well the fact that people have always struggled in trying to imagine what this biblical teaching would look like when it happens. John did a devotional Wednesday night or two ago for us, where he read about the need to love, and I noticed he asked, "What would that look like in real life?" Well, what would this look like in real life? That's the hard thing to imagine. And look with me at Mark 12, starting at verse 19. This will be familiar to you, but I want to call your attention to one thing about it. Tucker, do you like to read? Would you like to start at 18 and read through 23 and stop there for us for just a second? Mark 12, 18 through 23.
Then the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him with a question. "Teacher," they said, "Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife and no children, the man must marry the widow and have children for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first one married and died without leaving any children. The second one marries a widow, but he also died, leaving no child. It was the same with the third. In fact, none of the seven left any children. Last of all, the woman who died too. At the resurrection, whose wife will she be, since the seven were married?"
Okay, now, we have here a somewhat obscure law of the Old Testament, which was intended for a very specific purpose and circumstance, and it was that when the tribes of Israel entered the promised land, and when by lot they drew a plot of the land or a section of the land to be the inheritance for that tribe, and then when the land was divided up into families, that inheritance was what was at stake in this law. It was a law which required that if an heir of that land married, and before anyone to carry on the family name was born, then that heir died, then the next brother was to father a child to carry on the family name. Now, that seems like an unimaginable circumstance to us, I believe. And it seems like maybe even a crude thing in some ways. But if you remember, that the entire idea was to retain possession of the family inheritance in the land, and to cause the lineage to continue to exist. Now, Notice that the Sadducees have used here the proposition of that law for an entirely different purpose. That law had nothing to do with resurrection. It was very much an earthbound law, and yet they have used it to pose the question, in what spirit do you, as you read this, is this question asked? In what tone of voice is it asked? And I'm going to try to make a point about our understanding of the resurrection of this.
I don't think they were seeking a true answer. I think they were mocking him and trying to trick him.
All right, a little bit of entrapment. I think there is a little bit of a sarcastic tone to this. There is a kind of a gotcha idea or tone of voice to this. Because they noticed that Mark notes that they already had in mind what they thought about the resurrection. They were not looking for truth. They said there is no resurrection. And we'll say more about that in just a second. But that's how they opposed this. In the resurrection, when they rise again, whose wife shall she be? Now, what concept, in their saying that there is no resurrection, what concept of the resurrection do the Sadducees assume before they say that? That's not a very clear... All right. All right. Their assumption in denying the resurrection is that the resurrection would mean this physical body would simply be reconstituted, and then we would carry on in life the same relationships and so forth of which we are capable now. That's their assumption, and they deny that because that seems impossible to them, and partly on the basis here of the assumption, all right, what would happen should these brothers all be raised up, and then this the wife of the older one would also be raised up? What would apply? That would be their idea. Now notice how the Lord responds to that, verse 24 and following, and this would be helpful to us in our further reading, I think. Tucker, carry on if you would. Verse 24 through 27.
Jesus replied, "Are you not there because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God? When the dead rise, they will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. Now about the dead rising, have you not read in the book of Moses and the account of the bush how God said to him, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob'? He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are badly mistaken."
All right. Now, two things about this that let's think about for just a minute. The error of which Jesus says the Sadducees are to be convicted here is that, first, they don't know what the Scriptures teach about this hope, and second, they don't know about God's power. God's power can do what you and I are not capable of imagining, and Scripture doesn't teach the concept of resurrection that these fellows had in mind. Now, he says then two things about the case when they rise from the dead. And these two things we will pursue further. First, he says they neither marry nor are given in marriage. What does that say to you?
It's not going to be like it is here.
All right. Number one, the resurrection body would not be as it is now, and resurrection relationships would not be as they are now, partly because in the resurrection there is no need to procreate to bear children and to repopulate and so forth, which we do in this life, in this physical body. That is something which is not imaginable for us. We cannot conceive of life in which there is no marrying and reproducing, and we may not even be able to conceive of how it could be that we could be happy and fulfilled without that kind of relationship and oneness about our lives. And yet, that's what Jesus is saying here, that there is not that kind of thing. Now, he says, secondly, they are like the angels in heaven at the end of verse 25. I want to urge us to be careful with this thought for a second. It doesn't say that those who have died and are raised up are angels. I hear in popular culture, I hear that idea quite a bit. Even I've had to do a memorial service recently where I heard that said by someone, that this individual is now an angel. A human being is not an angel, will never be an angel. That the Bible teaches that the angels are ministering spirits for the sake of those that God has brought to salvation. Look at Hebrews 13 in chapter 1, verses 13 and 14 would kind of show you that. Now, secondly, in what way? And notice that the Lord is trying to make a particular point. In what way are in the resurrection, are we like the angels? That's right. We don't marry or raise children or anything like that. Notice that that is the singular point that Jesus is making when it comes to the mention of angels. Now we want to bear that in mind. Now, as for the other thing that he says, you don't know the power of God. What do you make of his statement in verses 26 and following? Have you not read? And I like it. He calls it in the book of Moses. This is actually Exodus. At the bush, you remember Exodus 3, that it's burning, but it's not being consumed. And after Moses is told to take off his shoes and this is holy ground and all of that, and God speaks to him. And I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. That seems like a straightforward statement that has nothing to do with resurrection. What do you make of that statement? What point is Jesus trying to make with that statement?
God's saying in the present he is.
All right. That God is saying in the present tense, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And what is the significance of his using the present tense? And what would that have to do with resurrection? All right. Abraham had lived over 400 years before this. He would have been forgotten by most human standards and so forth. And Isaac, of course, he'd been gone slightly less time and so forth. The idea is, though, that God still regarded them as present individuals, living in some sense. The Lord's application is God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And the Sadducees were missing that point. Now, here's the question, you see, and here's how this applies to the resurrection. How can these who have died be regarded as living?
They didn't go into nothing.
They didn't.
They still haven't existed.
They did not simply cease to exist, did they? They are therefore not merely physical organisms, biological organisms. And the only way that reality can be conceived or imagined is either if God allows them to continue as simply spirit entities who are real to him but who do not have any other bodily existence. That's one possibility. And the other possibility is resurrection, a new body. And what the Bible's assumption is, and this is where I'm headed to with this, is that the Bible does not envision persons without bodies. In no circumstance does the Bible make that kind of assumption, and in Hebrew thinking and so forth, the Jewish thinking of Jesus' time, they didn't conceive of things in that way. Now, the Lord has left a whole bunch of this unanswered in this particular conversation, but look how effectively He has answered the entrapment proposition the Sadducees have posed. You are quite wrong. You don't know the Scriptures or the power of God. Ruth?
Now, they thought when you died, you just quit existing, period?
Okay, let me answer that by taking us to another passage, okay? The Sadducees were the materialist thinkers of the New Testament time, or that segment of the Jewish population. Let's look at three statements from Paul, all while he's on trial, and I think in Acts, and this will help us, I think, to answer Ruth's question. A good question. Acts 24. Let's start in Acts 24, verse 14 and 15, especially. Dan, I'll ask you to read this for us. Acts 24, verses 14 and 15, and this is Paul when they. When they bring him before trial at Caesarea, the first one before Felix, I think, and the Jews have come accusing him, the enemies from Jerusalem have come accusing him of being the ringleader of the Nazarenes and so forth, and this is part of Paul's defense here. Okay. Acts 24, 14 and 15.
But this I admit to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked.
All right, now, What Paul is saying is that in general, the Jewish authorities who were before him there had a hope in the prophets and the law, and their hope was that there would be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. Mark that in your mind for just a minute, the idea that there would be a resurrection of the just and the unjust. Now, back up a little bit to Acts 23, verses 6 and following. And we're going to go through 8 here, and this will get closer to Ruth's question. Bear in mind, though, the general Jewish outlook was, the more common one was the idea that there will be a resurrection of the just and the unjust. Now, Acts 23, verses 6 through 7. Well, 6 through 8. We'll say. Brendan, read that, please.
But perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, "Brethren, I'm a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I'm on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, or spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledged them all.
Okay, now, Ruth, that is as close as I can get to answering the specific question. The general Jewish outlook was that there would be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust, the righteous and the unrighteous. The Pharisees, however, were the materialists in the group. They, in order to say there is no resurrection. They also said there is no angel, nor is there any spirit. And you can see how different that is from the biblical outlook and also from the common Jewish outlook. And my best guess on why they took that approach is that they were pretty satisfied with how things were. The Sadducees were wealthy. They controlled the priestly offices in Jerusalem at the time. They are the ones that formed partnerships with the Roman rulers and had influence and authority in that way. And it seems to me that the more wealth and power people gain, the more likely they are to claim that things will go on like they are. I don't know how they dealt with death, though. Okay. I saw that question coming. I don't know how they dealt with that. Tom?
Bill, in my version, there in verse 6, Paul even went as far, it says, he cried out in the council, men and brethren.
Yeah.
He separated himself from even the philosophy of the Sadducees.
Yeah. He uses the division that he already recognizes as a partly in his defense, and the reason being, people can hate each other more than they will be for any particular point of truth or doctrine, and that's kind of what happens here. Now look also while we're looking at Paul's speeches, look over at Acts 26, and I want for us to notice verses 6 through 8. I mentioned this in a sermon recently, and undoubtedly you all will remember every word of that. So this may not be necessary, but I think it. I fear that it is. Randy, would you read for us Acts 26, 6 through 8?
And now I stand here on trial because of my hope and the promise made by God to our fathers, to which our 12 tribes hope to attain, as they earnestly worship night and day. And as for this hope, I am accused by Jews, O king. Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead?
Okay, now Paul has done two things in these statements. He has said, first, that he holds a hope that there will be a resurrection of the just and the unjust, and that this is the hope that the prophets and Moses taught and held, and that someone who does not share this hope ought to have to explain why. And this is Ruth's question about the Pharisees, I think, illustrates this. All right, if you don't share this hope, then how do you think God's promises are going to be fulfilled? How do you believe that it will make any difference how a person has lived, that how a person has lived will have any meaning, that how the cause of God will have any kind of a bearing really on history? How is it that a God who created the body in the first place and gave life in the first place could not recreate the body? That's the question that Paul has. Now, the idea of the resurrection of the just and the unjust is assumed in many passages in the New Testament. I'll try to call your attention to those. But I want to back up for just these next few minutes and ask, how did this idea develop in the Old Testament Scriptures, and where is it taught in Old Testament Scriptures, and how could Paul say that he was only holding the hope that the fathers had? Let's look at a few of these and maybe comment on how they become ingrained in the thought of believers in the Old Testament. Look back with me to Job to start with. Job 13 would be a good place to begin. And please bear in mind that Jesus took this back to the burning bush, you know, Exodus 3. And Jesus took it back to who God is and what God is like. He's the God of the living. Job 13, verse 15. Job says, though he slay me, and that would refer to what event? Death, wouldn't it? Though he slay me, I will hope in him. All right, how can you hope if you're going to be slain? All right, you would have to believe there is something beyond that, wouldn't you, in order for that statement to be made? I realize he could be saying, this is how strong my commitment is. I'm going to hope in him even if I die. But why would you, what would be the hope in that? Yet I will argue my ways to his face. And this is Job in his insistence that his case is just. Look at Job 14 in verse 1. This is a famous statement, but I believe it illustrates man's hunger and thirst for something beyond this. Man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. Now, when you hear a statement like that, do you anticipate that he will say, and I'm satisfied for it to be that way? Or isn't it saying, we have a longing for there to be something other than this? Skip over to Job 19 now. Oh, excuse me, Job 14:14. I wanted to mention before we skip over it. If a man dies, what? Shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my, and the ESV uses the word renewal. Some of the others will say relief or something like that, I think. What does yours have?
Change.
Change, right, my change. So a lot of people see a shadow of the hope and resurrection in that. And then Job 19. In verses 25 and 26, read these for us. Casey, you or Becky, one, if you will. Job 19, 25 and 26.
For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God.
All right, now isn't that an amazing statement with what evidence that Job had the opportunity to see? Can you see how the theme of resurrection is in that, implied in that statement? After my skin has been thus destroyed, and the ESV has, yet in my flesh I shall see God. There's no way that kind of thing could happen unless God provided another body, a different body. We run out of time. Look quickly at Psalm 17. And I wish I hadn't spent so much time in the other part. Psalm 17, verse 15. Do we have a reader of this one?
For me, I will see your face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake in your likeness.
All right, isn't that a wonderful statement? I'll be satisfied when I awake in your likeness. That's where the hope of resurrection comes from. Look maybe at the same opening at Psalm 16 and verse 10. I'm going to read it and you tell me where you recognize these words. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. Do you recognize those words? Where do we hear them in the New Testament usually?
Acts.
All right, in Acts. In Acts 2 especially, Acts 13. These are the very words that both Peter and Paul used to argue that the Lord, Jesus Christ, has been raised up. And the viewpoint of the New Testament is, all right, if Jesus has been raised up, there is such a thing as a resurrection. So it's not impossible. Look at Daniel 12 in verse 2. And this is the one whose phraseology gets used maybe more often in the New Testament, Daniel 12 and verse 2. There may be some some symbolism in this, with Israel coming back from exile, from Babylonian exile, but the point, this is the language the New Testament adapts to speak of resurrection. John, would you read it for us?
Verse 2.
Uh-huh.
And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt.
While you're doing it, read 3 as well.
And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever.
All right, now look in verse 2 especially. These who sleep, and this is a particular kind of sleep because it says who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, and then the everlasting life and everlasting contempt are mentioned after that or as a result of that. Now, here's kind of where we are with this. Jesus has taught that the resurrection is not to be understood as the same physical world or physical life as we have now. Not the same relationships, not the same cycle of life, and so forth. He has said that the resurrection instead will be based not in the nature of man, but in the nature of God. If you follow the line of thought, follow what he says. We shouldn't begin in thinking about this with how we are now, but with how God is now. And then we should understand from what we read that God answers this innate human longing for life. I've been to the memorial services. I've done memorial services for believers and unbelievers and people who believed in God and people who have ignored God. And friends, every single one of them, the people come when everybody's gone and I'm standing there, somebody will say, "He's gone to a better place." Every family. There is an innate hunger or thirst for life. And the New Testament, in fact, entire Bible's teaching is that that comes because we're made in God's image. And that God seeks to answer that thirst like He answers other hungers and thirsts in life. He provides an answer for it. And next week we'll try to take up the so-called theological reasoning that leads to resurrection. Don't be scared off by that. The idea is simply, all right, if this desire is there, how does the resurrection of Christ answer that, and what does the resurrection of Christ say about our own resurrection? What is our hope in this way after all? Appreciate y'all being with us today. Hope everybody has a good week.